On this episode of This Week in Space, it's time to talk about who's in charge up there. We're joined by Dr. George Neild, formerly of the FAA's Office of Commercial Space Transportation. Stay with us.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 89, recorded on December 1st, 2023. Who's in charge in space? This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Bitwarden, the open source password manager to help you stay safe online. Get started with a free Teams or Enterprise plan trial, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Space, the Who's in Charge edition. New space is upon us, as you know if you listen to our podcast, because we talk about it all the time. And a lot of private operators from SpaceX to Virgin Galactic to Blue Origin and more are headed into the big black and beyond into orbit. There's a widely held view that these activities need to be regulated, just as civil aviation has been regulated for decades. The question is, by whom and how? Today, FAA veteran George Neild, who is uber qualified to weigh in, and when I say uber, I mean uber, joins us to explore these challenging questions. Hello, George, and thanks for coming.
Nice to be here. Thanks a lot.
But before we embark on this venture, we have one space joke and one non-space joke. Tarek, are you ready to laugh yourself sick?
Well, I'll only laugh at the space joke, not the non-space joke.
Oh, no.
And forgive me if I sound off. I've got a bit of a bug right now. So I kind of sound like a frog meets some sandpaper.
Well, you're always a little off, so we're okay. But don't worry about it. All right. Oh,
wait, was that the non-space joke?
Because No. This comes from hardcore space ranger Guy Couturier. I think I pronounced that correctly. This me in French words. Hey, Tarek, they found that hair pieces don't work well in the microgravity environment of space, but a $2 adapter can hold them on for balding astronauts. That's a small price to pay.
Oh, I got it. I got it.
Like it? Okay.
Or not to pay. All right, yeah. I got it.
Actually, I was good. I wrote him a kind of a likely thank you because this was one of the best.
Okay, that was good. That was good.
Right? Okay, and but you I'm think that was good. Guy.
It took me a little bit, but maybe that's longer okay. than I should have.
Somebody's got to sit in the back of the classroom. Might as well be you. All right, next. A bartender says, "We don't serve your kind here." A time traveler walks into a bar.
Ha ha ha.
I like that one. All right. Well, as always, we invite you to join the Space Rangers and send you just your best or worst. Yeah, okay. From the peanut gallery. Space joke. Don't forget to do us a solid, make sure to like, subscribe, and all the podcast things, because we love you and we know you love us. So let's get some headlines done so we can talk to George, because I can't wait to hear what he's got to say. Tarek.
I'm here for it.
From Space News, I'm shocked to hear that the GAO report warns Artemis 3 landing may be delayed till 2027, optimistically.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. So this brand new report from the Government Accounting Office that just came out yesterday as we're recording this has basically said it is, quote unquote, I don't know if you can see my air quotes if you're watching the stream, that it is unlikely that the Artemis 3 moon landing, the first astronaut moon landing of the Artemis program, will actually fly in 2025. And I know, right? It's for the reasons that the whole mission was pushed back to 2025 from 2024, which is like in 5 weeks, right? As we're recording this, in the first place, it's the fact that the primary lander for the spacecraft, the SpaceX Starship, most likely will not be ready to carry people to the moon, in by the end of the calendar year, and challenges with the actual spacesuits. And so there's two different companies that are at play here. Number one, of course, is SpaceX, which just launched their second Starship test flight, didn't reach, their orbital, goals, although they did make some progress from the first one, back in April. And the kind of big tent pole there is the fact that SpaceX has identified the need for multiple in-flight, like in-space refueling operations basically to get a Starship all the way to the moon with, you know, with a crew and whatnot. And this report, and I was really floored when I said it, just said that based on reports that NASA has submitted to the GAO, that they haven't seen substantial progress, if any, on that part of it. And it's a big part of it. And it's not surprising why they wouldn't have made that kind of advancements, because they haven't got the rocket into orbit yet, you know, or landed one of them yet. And so they have to get that part done first. And so that was just really disappointing to read, because you kind of had hoped that they'd be able to actually make it on the way. And the other part was just with the Axiom Space spacesuits. Now, Axiom has a contract with NASA to make the surface spacesuits to compete to do them. But they have a lot of challenges for, the life support system and like the surface systems and whatnot. And they haven't been able to get as far as they would need to be ready to fly there too. So those two things are the big tentpole. But you do need a lander if you're going to land astronauts. And I think that's probably the bigger fish to fry. And we're still waiting to find out when SpaceX will be able to make the progress that they need to make to get there. They're going to have to fly a lot more test flights for one thing, and then start landing the rockets and then start refueling the rockets. And then the life support thing, which we haven't gotten any updates on at all. And all of that was kind of touched on in this 40-page report by the GAO to say, they still need to solve these problems. And it's just so frustrating, because these are the problems that pushed it back from 2024 in the same place. And we're in the first place, and we're kind of in the same scenario right now.
So we have an expert in the room, George. You worked for NASA for quite some time. And I all the people I know that have worked for NASA for quite some time have a few scars to show for it. And you learn, right? I mean, you learn how things work there. I mean, I haven't worked for them more than a few years, but I even learned some things, which is kind of remarkable. If you were in charge of the EVA suit program, if the bid from the company that made them the first time around came back close to the bid from a new contender, might you go with the original supplier, since even though there's a lot of knowledge loss since then, you know they can do it? Or is that just not how it works?
Traditionally, that's what they would have done. But I think really we're seeing a new way of doing business, trying to have government and industry more as a partnership, and making sure wherever possible that we can have competition. And so if there are capable entities out there that are interested in being part of the program, I think it can be helpful in the long run to have additional players, so that you're not just stuck with one supplier who, given a particular problem, whether technical or monetary, whatever, would slow up the whole program.
Were you surprised that SpaceX didn't bid or wasn't considered? I wasn't clear which.
Again, I don't know the inside scoop on whether they did or not, but again, following the philosophy of trying to have multiple folks as part of the overall program, I think it's great to spread the participation around a little bit in the long run.
Tarek, was the original, was the Apollo the 7 suit by Hamilton or Collins? Do you remember?
I thought it was by Hamilton, but I could be wrong. But the spacesuit aside, to George's point and your question, if NASA had done that for this lander, right? Or for crew transport, they would have, they could have gone just with Boeing, because they were the tried and true partner, and Boeing still hasn't flown their crewed one. Meanwhile, SpaceX has been able to do it, and so
I was just talking about the EVA suit.
Yeah. So, but yeah, Collins has they have a prototype. Axiom Space has a prototype. There's one more right from ILC, I think. There's a few, but SpaceX is focused on the lander. They have to get that set. It won't surprise me if they're developing their own suit internally, because they have to have their own spacesuit anyway. They are flying a private mission with Jared Isaacman to do a commercial spacewalk. So
yeah. All right. Next up, Cannibal Star. Oh, this is from space.com. Cannibal Solar Burst will hit Earth.
That's right.
Really now, you are the king. Catchy titles, aren't you?
I don't name them these cannibal coronal mass
injections.
You're
the editor-in-chief. You get to say whatever you want.
These are what the Space Weather Prediction Group, they call them these things. But no, there was a massive coronal mass ejection on November 29th, which is my mother's birthday, also Zadie's birthday, my daughter, and my aunt, because my mom is a twin.
Okay.
That's the sun is, it's the sun's, you know, fireworks for their birthdays. And that CME, the fallout from that is bombarding our magnetic field right now and lighting up the auroras. I mean, it was a pretty strong solar eruption. An M9.8 on the class, very close to an X flare, which is the strongest they can have, and it was really exciting to see. They think that there could be auroras all the way down to the northern United States, which is exciting because we usually don't see auroras that low. And I'm really hopeful that if the weather clears, maybe we could see some here even in New Jersey. But that's a really too much to hope for, given the amount of light pollution that we have here. Mm. But it's kind of we're going into a really active period of the sun's weather now, and they're calling it solar maximum. And so we are going to see more of these solar eruptions over time. It's nothing to worry about for the most part, because they can predict when they're going to happen, and we can prepare for them, and hopefully safeguard astronauts and spacecraft and satellites in orbit, against them. But hopefully, we get these amplified solar northern lights displays that come out of it, and you know we can all kind of enjoy in that part of Mother Nature's light show.
All right, let's jump to a break, and then we'll be back, and it'll be all George all the time. Stay with us. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Bitwarden, the only open source cross-platform password manager you can trust. Security Now's Steve Gibson even switched over, and that's saying something. With Bitwarden, all the data in your vault is end-to-end encrypted, not just your passwords. Bitwarden protects you by creating unique usernames and adding strong, randomly generated passwords for each account or using any of their 6 integrated email alias services. You can log into Bitwarden and decrypt your vault after using SSO on a registered trusted device. No master password is needed. On top of being public to the world, Bitwarden has professional third-party audits performed yearly and published on its website. You can even view all of Bitwarden's code on GitHub. Share private data securely with fully customizable plans for personal or business needs. Start with a personal plan for free forever and get unlimited devices, unlimited passwords, and passkey management. Or you can enjoy premium features by upgrading to a premium account for less than $1 per month. And for only $3.33 a month, the plan I chose, their family plan will give you up to 6 accounts with premium features and unlimited sharing and collections. Their enterprise plan is just $6 per user per month. And they now have a team starter plan, which is a flat $20 per month for 10 users, which provides a great value for smaller teams with all the premium features. Or you can pay $4 a month per user with teams of 11 or more. Join Bitwarden at the 4th Annual Open Source Security Summit, where businesses, open source enthusiasts, developers, and security thought leaders come together to explore how open source software leads to stronger cybersecurity. Headliners this year include Brian Krebs from Krebs and Security, white hat hacker and CEO of Social Proof Security Rachel Toback, and generative AI expert and advisor Zach Cass. Join the leaders in open source security and register now for the Open Source Security Summit on December 7th at opensourcesecuritysummit.com. At Twit, we're fans of password managers. Get started with Bitwarden's free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit. All right, we're back. And George, thanks again for hanging in there with us. You are an aerospace and astronautical engineer with a PhD from Stanford. I did buy the sweatshirt on campus. I'm not a poser. Former head of the FAA's Commercial Space Transportation Office and an astronaut. Now we get to call you. That's, you know, in the land of complete resumes, which I don't have, that's a pretty complete resume. But you've also done a lot of other stuff. So if you just give us sort of a thumbnail of your career and how you got where you are now and what you are currently doing with your new enterprise here.
So growing up, I loved airplanes and space. And wanted to pursue that through the rest of my career in life. Went to the Air Force Academy in Colorado for undergraduate because I thought that would be a great way to prepare myself for aerospace things. Also have a chance to have a challenge, which I enjoy, and to serve our country. And my first assignment out of the Air Force Academy was to go to Stanford to get my master's degree in aeronautics and astronautics. And then on to Los Angeles to work on some military space programs for a year. And heard about the Air Force Test Pilot School now opening things up to not just test pilots, but flight test engineers, people who could fly in the back seat and help to take data and call out the test points and so forth. And that sounded fantastic. So I had a chance to go through that year-long program and fly in the back seat of T-38s and F-4s, T-33s, lots of high-performance aircraft, and I really enjoyed that. Later on, worked at Edwards for a while the NASA's Space Shuttle Enterprise was doing its approach and landing tests. So you can walk out the back door and see some of those tests right from the neighborhood. That was pretty amazing. And then NASA announced they were going to open up their astronaut program because they had this new vehicle called the Space Shuttle, and you didn't have to be a test pilot to be an astronaut anymore. And so thought that might be a fun thing to do. Applied for that program, was called down for an interview and a physical, did not make the final cut. And when I looked at all the folks who had been selected, there was a lot of PhDs on their resumes, and I thought, I guess that's what I need to do. So Air Force sent me back to Stanford to get my PhD there, and then ended up teaching at the Air Force Academy to pay back the Air Force for sponsoring me there. And then as soon as I could, was assigned down to the Johnson Space Center in Houston. At that time, the Air Force was planning to have its own space shuttle fly from Vandenberg and have its own control center and all the rest. And so they were sending a bunch of Air Force folks down to learn from NASA how to do this. And that was pretty exciting. And then all of a sudden, Challenger happened. Air Force sort of lost interest in human space flight. I was having a great time there. And so decided to stay on at NASA. Leave the Air Force and worked on the space shuttle program and then the space station program for a number of years as a NASA civil servant. Later on, worked for Orbital Sciences Corporation for a few years in industry and then returned to the government in the Office of Commercial Space Transportation in the FAA, where I served as the associate administrator for 10 years between 2008 and 2018. And retired from the government in 2018, but this is such an exciting time for commercial space. I didn't want to just sit back and go fishing. And so I'm trying to help out where I can, have my own company to help out with consulting or providing feedback and advice to take advantage of all the great things that are going on these days. And George, then after I had retired, the opportunity arose for me to buy a ticket on Blue Origin's New Shepard rocket. And so after having worked on human spaceflight for my whole life, basically, to have the chance to personally experience that, it was just an awesome experience. Just fantastic.
Oh, I have so many questions for you, George, about that flight. So many. But I did want to ask about a lot of the policies and the work that you had done and that you saw that led up to that flight before we got there. But really quickly, because I'm not sure if I caught it before, because you said that you knew that you were really excited about space and you wanted to do stuff. Was there something that bit you early for that? I mean, like, was it watching missions on TV or like
it, really appealed to me. And so I would scour the newspaper and magazines for articles about the space chimps, and I had myself a little scrapbook, and when NASA selected its astronauts and so forth, and would collect all that, and you see Sputnik go over and all those kinds of things, and that was just something, wow, I got to be part of this.
So, and the work that you're doing now with commercial space technologies, I mean, you mentioned you're retired from the government, so are you looking at, like, are you kind of, do you see yourself now as kind of a resource for all these companies that are that are, you know, up and comers versus the ones that are maybe a little more established, like Blue Origin, like SpaceX?
So just helping out where I can. I'm on some advisory boards. I've been helping out quite a bit lately with spaceports, mm-hmm. So that we can have successful places to launch and land and do other things, not just at the Kennedy Space Center in Vandenberg, but can have a network, basically, of spaceports all over the world to increase access to space and to facilitate continued growth in the global space economy.
You know, I was curious at the kind of, I don't know, the perceived explosion of activity in commercial space that the public, you know, may have seen over the last like 10, 15 years. You know, it was well underway during your time at the FAA, but, you know, we've seen so many new entrants, so many new successes, especially like with commercial crew and commercial flight, where you've got SpaceX launching people into orbit, you know, on private missions. They've sold trips around the moon, stuff that used to be almost like PowerPoint demonstrations and whatnot. But they're real now, and we hear about like the FAA's involvement a lot. But it seems like there's several different agencies, like the FCC, I think, is working on satellites and whatnot, or the Department of Transportation. I guess there was some stuff coming in there, and I'm curious, you know, if you have a really strong sense if it should be only like the FAA or who should be overseeing. I don't know if we even should call it new space anymore, because it's been going on for quite some time, but these commercial activities in space.
So, great question. If you were starting with a clean sheet of paper today, you'd probably do it a little bit differently and hopefully have a more efficient operation that would be simpler to understand and still do all the right things. But over the years, it has developed in a slightly different way. And so today, there are actually three different U.S. government entities that are regulating space activities. So the FAA licenses commercial launches and reentries. The FCC is in charge of radio broadcasts from space. And NOAA is responsible for remote sensing, basically taking pictures of the Earth or other objects in space. And so those are the three regulatory agencies. Obviously, NASA and the Department of Defense are big players in space, but they're not regulators, and they don't want to be. And so the challenge has been to try to figure out how to do two things, which is really part of the FAA's Office of Commercial Space Transportation mission. First, to ensure public safety during these commercial launches and reentry activities. But secondly, their mandate is to encourage, facilitate, and promote commercial space transportation. Mm-hmm. Some people see that as a huge conflict, and, oh my goodness, we can't do that. But I thought that was a very nice combination. You're trying to make sure that the public is safe while still allowing these activities to go forward with innovative solutions. And, of course, the safest thing to do is not launch at all, but that's not the right answer. You're trying to do these two things together.
So, you know, I come from your generation, I think. I was born in 1956, so I saw this stuff evolving as I grew up. And the space race from roughly 1957 to 1972-ish was kind of a rough and ready time. You know, you built it, you flew it again 2 months later, you went to the moon again 2 months later, not all the time, but frequently enough that it was pretty amazing. And it was a national priority. NASA since then has become much more careful and safety conscious, understandably, given some of what they've been through. I was writing about the Skylab repair mission, Skylab 2 flight run by Pete Conrad the other day, reminded of, you know, he went off script a little bit when they were fixing that by standing underneath that cable, and those two guys stood up at the same time to try and get the solar panel to swing out. I don't think that would have happened today with the kind of planning we do. And that's okay. But I am getting to a point here, which is we have a number of agencies, and it's important to regulate big flaming bombs that are going up. And it's important to regulate big, heavy spacecraft that are coming back that can cause a crater in a neighborhood and so forth. I think the part and I admit to a little boomer bias here, so take it easy on me, Tarek. But I think the part that kind of gets me is if you have a dashing gray river smelt off the coast of Boca Chica, and seven of them might get crushed if the rocket crashes in the water. I'm obviously exaggerating, being a little sarcastic, but fish and game, you know, standing in the way of a launch for however long that mattered. You know, it's kind of a national priority. There's a national security aspect to getting Starship going. There's, of course, the perception of a new space race with China. There's a lot of things that a place like China doesn't have to worry about. They can drop second stages on entire villages. We don't want to do that. But sometimes it feels like, you know, protecting a couple of flounders down off the beach is a little more than we need to do. I'm not trying to lay out a minefield for you to walk through, but do you have any thoughts about that on your own? Are we being a little overly cautious, perhaps?
No. Those are good questions, great observations. Let me provide a little bit of context, though. I think we're, frankly, in the middle of a significant transformation in terms of how we do space. Ever since the Soviet Union launched Yuri Gagarin into orbit, making him the first person to leave the planet, almost everything that has happened in space that has been important, significant, major accomplishment has been done by the government. So the X-15 program, Project Mercury, Project Gemini, the Apollo moon landings, 30 years of flying the space shuttle, and then building and living and working on board the International Space Station. That's been the government that has been responsible for planning and developing and carrying out those programs. But going forward, that is not necessarily going to be the case, because I think private industry is playing an increasingly important role. And there's a number of reasons for that that we're starting to see based on the winning of the Ansari X Prize and the COTS program, commercial cargo, commercial crew. What we're seeing is, with more significant industry involvement, it is possible to have lower costs, increased innovation compared to what the government is comfortable with. I think, frankly, a greater risk tolerance, the opportunity for new products and services and customers. That's not the government's job to do, but that's what business is all about, right? And the opportunity for new sources of funding and investments. So we don't have to rely on congressional appropriations that are using taxpayer dollars to pay for these launches. So all of those things are helping industry to be successful in an amazing way. If you just look at what's going on in the last few years, the number of launches is really increasing. For several years, we only saw a handful of FAA license launches every year. And then so far this year, there have been 106, and there's still a month left in the year. That curve just goes up exponentially, and there's no signs of that turning around or even leveling off.
Well, that transformation, George, I mean, I'm wondering from the public's eye, how much of that went smoothly and how much of it was a challenge to change the systems in place, right? Because I remember a situation, you know, many years ago where SpaceX had, you know, to work with the Air Force to get a launch pad, and they weren't allowed to launch from there, you know, even though they had worked to get that out of Vandenberg. Now that they just launched actually today from that same pad, but they had to go all the way out to Omelette Island way back when. And yet now they're launching like 2-3 times a week. And to the average person, it just seems like it's always been that way. But it seems like it was a long haul to get there over the last 15 years to get to this point.
I think many parts in the government, NASA, military, the general public, just assume that, hey, the government is the one that does space. You know, who are these people working in their garage or a small company or a new company I haven't heard of? And yet, even though many of them fail, run out of money, or have technical problems, we're seeing how amazing the progress can be for the handful of companies that are able to get things right. And that's starting to pay off. And I think NASA is getting that message, and DOD as well.
All right, we're going to go to a quick break, and we will be back with more exciting content. Don't go anywhere.
In Puerto Rico, we call ourselves Boricua. We're proud, passionate, and full of life. On our island, adventure finds you. Strangers aren't strangers for long. The size of the audience doesn't change the beauty of the music. And we celebrate every last ray of sun. Live Boricua.
And we're back. So I think you explained that really well. You know, there's a lot going on. We've been calling it new space for years. I still call it that. But a lot of new operators, a lot of private enterprise companies, SpaceX in particular, I mean, talk about putting skin in the game. And I was adding up some numbers yesterday, again, for this article I was working on. Clearly, had SpaceX, and I don't want to put all the credit on them, but they've earned an awful lot of it. Had SpaceX not come along and figured out how to do affordable, reusable launch vehicles, our launch rate would be well behind China's at this point, I think, you know, because SpaceX has just really kind of taken over the global market to some extent. And of course, inherent in that is belly aching about regulation. And there's a fair amount of that that goes on. You know, in the magazine I edit, we get op-eds every now and then with crusty old guys like me saying, oh, they got to loosen up. And who cares about the tortoises in the New Mexico spaceport? Take off anyway, and that kind of thing. What, and this is a really broad question, I apologize in advance, but what's the right amount and right type of regulation for these potentially very dangerous machines going to and from space, not just protecting us down here, but to the extent that you can with private spaceflight in particular, protecting the people that have signed a waiver saying they might blow up when they fly on this thing?
So that's a challenge, and the whole government and the whole country really have to decide how we want to tackle that challenge. So historically, there's been a lot of attention on safety, appropriately so, when you have billions of tax dollars going for a particular program, and then you see it fail. Oh my goodness, you know, whose fault is that? And how can we find that person and punish them and so forth and so on? If it's industry doing it, sometimes they're going to fail. And that can be an important learning experience for making progress. But at the same time, if there are people involved, then maybe there should be a different standard. So today, the system that we're operating under, which was crafted by Congress basically in 2004 in the Commercial Space Launch Amendments Act, said, all right, FAA, we want you to continue to protect the uninvolved public who didn't sign up for these risky missions. You can't have rockets crashing into Disney World and all the rest. But in terms of the people who actually fly on these flights, it's going to operate under something they refer to as informed consent. So it's similar to if you have a major medical operation, the doctor has to tell you, well, it probably won't happen, but this could happen, this could happen, and so forth. So yes, you could be injured. You could be killed. Do you still want to go? If so, sign here. And so that's how we're operating today. That is completely different from how we're flying on commercial airliners today.
Right.
And I think that's an appropriate distinction. I mean, if you look at our safety record for human spaceflight, United States has launched on the order of 400 human spaceflights, and four of those have ended with a fatal accident. One X-15, Space Shuttle Challenger, Space Shuttle Columbia, and an early test flight of Spaceship Two. So four out of 400. That's a 1% fatal accident rate, which is about 10,000 times more dangerous than a commercial airliner would be. So we've got some learning to do, but at the same time, if we want to make progress, we need to allow the companies and the people who are willing to accept those risks to go ahead so that we can learn how to build safer, more reliable, and less expensive ways to travel to space in the future.
Well, and to be fair, well, it's a lot more dangerous than civil aviation is today if you compare it to the beginnings of civil aviation when people were riding in Well, I'd say at the beginning, I guess you'd have to go back to barnstorming. So a canvas airplane with two positions, much less a Ford tri-motor. I suspect the accident rate was higher then than it is now.
For sure.
And, you know, that's the cost of pioneering. But I guess listening to what you said makes a lot of sense. And informed consent, of course, that doesn't stop lawyers from trying to sue because, oh, they didn't understand or whatever. But then there's the people on the ground, of course, who, as you say, are disinterested parties. And they don't want, you know, chunks of a starship falling into their pool or something worse. So who, you kind of laid this out how it is, but moving ahead, do you see a different distribution of what agencies control what, or will there be a new agency as this evolves, or do we kind of keep it as it is in terms of private operators?
So I think there's room for improvement. As I look at what's been happening in the last few years, again, great things in the industry, a lot of progress, but understanding how the bureaucracy operates, I think it's fair to say that for the last several years, the Office of Commercial Space Transportation, which is one of the lines of business in the FAA, has not always received the needed time and attention from senior leadership. The ability to directly communicate with key stakeholders, White House, Congress, National Space Council, the media, the public, the resources to successfully carry out their mission, and advocacy and support in resolving key issues in a timely fashion. And you just look at the budgets. Gosh, we had a Senate hearing recently, and Bill Gerstenmaier now supports SpaceX, was saying, Congress, you need to double the budget of this office that regulates us. I mean, what kind of a picture is this? Because they recognize that even though the number of launches has gone up by a factor of 10, the budget's been flat, the staffing's been flat, and it's only a small percentage, less than half of 1% of the FAA's budget and the FAA staffing levels. So I think, frankly, it may be time for a change.
Yeah.
And one way that you could change that would be to have the Office of Commercial Space Transportation pulled out from under the FAA and go back to reporting to the Secretary of the Department of Transportation, which is where it was originally in 1984, when it was created in response to President Reagan's executive order, and a few months later, Congress passed the Commercial Space Launch Act. So that's where the office was originally, and in 1995, it was moved to the FAA. And that may have been fine in those years, but I think right now, given how important space is to the country and all of the exciting things happening, I think it deserves to be an independent mode of transportation, just like aviation and highways and railways and maritime and all those, so that you at least have a seat at the table when you have important issues to discuss and decisions to be made, whether it's on budget or policy. And I think that has a lot of potential.
Yeah, that congressional hearing that you mentioned, with where Bill Gerstenmaier was speaking for SpaceX, I think there were representatives from Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin both there, you know, all saying that they've got the hardware ready. They want to do the test, and they keep running into these roadblocks. You know, that was actually a question that I wanted to ask about the pace of commercial space outpacing that of the systems that were set up to regulate, because it seems like we're at that point now. Yes. And I've seen a few instances of some cheeky companies going around regulations to try to get their stuff in space. There was, of course, the infamous swarm launch of satellites on an Indian rocket, where they kind of didn't get the approval for their satellite frequencies with the FCC. And then all of a sudden they had a bunch of satellites in space with nothing regulated. And there was also this report just recently from the White House, and you mentioned the National Space Council, from the White House National Space Councils, to proposed both to the House and the Senate that the split, like the mission authorization responsibilities that weren't governed by currently by like the FAA or the departments across the Department of Commerce and Transportation. And that's also getting some pushback. But is that kind of tweaking the adjustments that you see are needed, like to try to find what works now to adjust for that?
Absolutely. That is a very important issue, and it has to do with whether the United States is going to be perceived as complying with the Outer Space Treaty. Article 6 says non-governmental entities in space are supposed to be authorized and continuously supervised by the appropriate state party to the treaty. And the United States today, it is not clearly identified in any law or policy who, if anyone, is supposed to do that for things in space. FAA does the launch and they do the reentry, but who's looking at it in between? And so that's an important issue. And it's been talked about for 10 years, which is crazy. So we're going to have to move at a faster pace in deciding things and getting things done. Still can have a light touch on the regulatory burdens, but we want to be able to quickly make decisions and be innovative and move forward in a lot more efficient manner. And that's why I think potentially moving it up to DOT as an independent and separately recognized mode of transportation might be one approach.
You know, you mentioned safety earlier, George, about, you know, making sure that it's addressed just as it is, you know, when you and I and Rod get on planes to go to our own, you know, events or the holidays or whatnot. And I'm curious how you see the role of safety oversight evolving as the rise. I mean, we saw Virgin Galactic launch a crewed space flight once a month for like 4 months this year, which was just crazy how fast they were doing that. And at one point, Blue Origin was doing that too, and now they're working up to the resume flights in the near future. And you know, SpaceX has their own process with these really unique vehicles, and each one is doing like something different. And it seems like it's still very bespoke to address the safety concerns of each of those flights. Or at least types of vehicles going forward. But we have like there's a whole, you know, the Department of Transportation oversees a lot of that, you know, for air travel and for, you know, autos and for trains. And what is the current state of assessing crew safety for commercial flights? Not for like the NASA ones, but because, you know, obviously NASA's overseeing the safety of their astronauts, but, you know, for the Jared Isaacmans of the world, for you, George, when you went, you know, is there a standard framework where they just check, you know, Blue Origin check some boxes for it, or does every single flight have to be done from soup to nuts to make sure that it's all done with that informed consent that you were talking about earlier?
So that's an issue that a lot of people don't really understand. You are not required to have a brand new separate launch license every time you launch. The way things are today is once a launch license has been granted to a company for a particular rocket and a particular kind of mission, that's good for 5 years, and you can fly as many times as you want to do that. Now, FAA still has safety inspectors in ensuring that the companies are doing what they promised to do and what they're required to do under the law and the regulations. But it's not like starting with a whole bunch of new paperwork, unless you're making changes. If you're making changes, then you got to look at, did that affect the public safety of the particular operation? And with a company like SpaceX that likes to change and make things better, then that certainly can be more work than they would like to have. But aside from resources, which have been straining under the number of launches and reentries that we've been having in recent years, I think the overall system is a pretty good one. But moving forward, I think there is room for improvement there too. I would love to see us in a situation where companies could rely on a comprehensive set of voluntary industry consensus standards. They're the experts in mm-hmm. building and flying these rockets. And they know best where the risks are and how to mitigate them. But those are not in place yet. And so right now the FAA says, okay, here's the regulations, you got to follow.
And I guess just to follow up really quickly for that, are there any parallels to like the early days of like air travel for that kind of voluntary like set, like where the individual you know, airlines are, they'd say, okay, we're going to do these for our planes there. Or is this like, are we all still like in the kind of terra incognita where it comes to the commercial flights that we're seeing?
So there's a lot of analogies with aviation. Frankly, as you mentioned, I think a lot of our learning for aviation was learned the hard way, through the accidents, through the deaths. And then you, oh, I guess you shouldn't do it that way. Let's write a regulation that says you have to do it this way. And so that's a slow and non-ideal way to have your safety system put in place. I think we're a lot smarter than that now. And we've learned a lot over the last 62 years of flying people into space, right? And a lot of that was from NASA, but they shared what they've learned. And so I don't think it's fair to say, oh, well, industry is still learning how to do this. We know how to do it. We have a lot of room for improvement, but it's time to start writing down what we do know. We do know some things about how to ensure the safety in terms of the crew compartment and the atmosphere and the reentry heating and parachutes and all those kinds of things. So let's start writing those down so that each company doesn't have to learn things the hard way as they develop their own unique vehicle.
Well, we've come to that point in time where Tarek has started pulling out his fancy words like terra incognita, which takes us to your flight, which I'm dying to talk about as soon as we get back from this break. Go nowhere.
In Puerto Rico, we call ourselves Boricua. We are proud, passionate, and full of life. On our island, adventure finds you. Strangers aren't strangers for long. The size of the audience doesn't change the beauty of the music. And we celebrate every last ray of sun. Live Boricua.
So, George, you are a spaceman. Not many people get to say that. You know, that there was a time when I thought I wanted to be an astronaut someday until I had a brief moment of sitting in a Gemini capsule with the hatch down and thought, uh-oh. Not only could I not do this for 2 weeks like those guys did, I could not do it for 10 minutes. But you did. And I have to say, of the two systems available now for you know, passenger flights or whatever you want to call them, which is Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic. If I was spending the money, which isn't going to happen, it would have to be a Blue Origin because it's a rocket. It's not a rocket plane. I think rocket planes are cool. The X-15 program is awesome. Virgin Galactic's really neat. But if I'm going to pay money to go, I want it to go straight up and come back down under parachutes because that's what my heroes did in the 1960s. So a couple of questions for you. One, did that have any bearing in your decision, what you grew up seeing or came of age seeing? And two, I hate to ask this question because it's the one that always makes the moonwalkers cross their eyes, but what was it like?
So different companies are designing things in different ways. And frankly, I would have jumped at the chance to go on any of the vehicles you mentioned or on SpaceX as well. So They're all very exciting and I think doing a great job of developing their systems. And to answer your second question, it was awesome. Oh my God. The whole experience was an incredible one. Different companies have different kinds of vehicles and they're doing things in different ways. Blue Origin has decided that they would make their system completely autonomous. And so there's no pilot on board. There's nobody on the ground that is flying the thing. The computers are running the flight. And so that may worry some people. On the flip side, there's less chance of pilot error if there's no pilot. So once you get the computers and the software figured out, I think you're in pretty good shape. But that allowed Blue Origin to really streamline and shorten the training required. Instead of spending 6 months to learn how to operate all the systems and so forth, we reported in for 3 full days of training, which was spent going over things like how to strap yourself in and get out of your seat, both in 1G and 0G conditions, how to talk on the radio, understand the displays, and then respond to emergencies. And so we did that over and over and over again. And by the time you get to launch day, having run that rehearsal dozens of times, felt very confident and ready to go. Was very impressed with their training team, their engineers, the systems that they've come up with. And it was just a very positive experience. after liftoff, you're pushed back into your seat, had about 3 G's on ascent, and then after about a minute, you pass through maximum dynamic pressure, which you wouldn't know except for the note on the display. A little more than 2 minutes later, it's main engine cutoff, followed by a bang, and the capsule separates from the booster, and the booster falls back, lights its engine again, and lands on the pad. And we were given the go-ahead to unstrap and float around. And, of course, you do your somersaults and just feeling giddy. Had a picture with the rest of the crew members right in the center. But then I spent the rest of my time looking out the window. And that was the high point of the flight for me. You see the curvature of the Earth. You see this thin blue band that's the atmosphere that you're above. And you look above that, and instead of blue sky, it is the blackest black that you can imagine. And that whole picture was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. Photographs and videos just do not do it justice. Just an incredible view. It's just really, really amazing and very impressive. After about 3 minutes of microgravity, then had to get strapped back into your seats. The vehicle starts encountering the atmosphere, so you get pushed back in your seats. This time it was about 5.5 G's for a few seconds. So that's a bunch, but you have nice, comfortable, reclined cushion seats. And then the drogue parachutes come out, and then the big parachutes and a nice, smooth descent to the desert floor there, and a bunch of dust was kicked up, but that's just West Texas desert dust. And they fire some thrusters right at the end to make it even a softer landing. And just the whole thing was an amazing experience.
So, Tarek, I think if I'm counting correctly, 5.5 G's would make us about 1,500 pounds a piece up there.
Well, I'm that trying to not think about scary. It. That's so much worse than the Gravitron at the carnival, it's got to say.
So, George, you're talking about it being automatic. Dumb question, but is there a great big red button somewhere that says parachutes now in case they don't fire?
So there is a full team of folks in the Mission Control Center watching all the systems, and there are ways that they can override the computers if that should be necessary. But basically, the thing's flying itself, and it's monitoring the progress. And, of course, we saw on one of their most recent flights where it was not carrying people but carrying experiments. And when there was a problem with the vehicle starting to head off the trajectory, then again, the escape system was triggered and the capsule came down under a parachute just fine, and the booster was not recovered. So, yes, these are hard. There is risk involved, but they have systems to hopefully back things up and to recover the crew and the experiments in the event of a problem with the booster.
So you've made me insanely jealous with your description of this, especially the part where you say, you know, pictures and video, the thing you people on the ground see, just don't convey the wonder of it. But I have to think about Alan Stern, who just did Virgin Galactic and wrote a series of blog posts about it and made the point that he was doing research while he was up there, little, you know, short bursts of microgravity research. To me, this is a little bit like watching, would be, if I were to be so fortunate, a little bit like watching a shuttle launch or a solar eclipse. You know, I used to do that as a journalist through my camera, and then once the shuttle had departed Earth and was no longer in sight, or the eclipse was over, it's like I wasn't there because I was concentrating on the camera and the image and the technology and focusing. And if I'm going to get on one of these flights, either for money or because of my good looks or whatever, I don't want it. What are you laughing at?
No,
I don't want to be doing experiments or fiddling around with something. I want to just experience it, especially in the spacecraft you did, because you have living room picture windows looking out into space. I mean, would you have been willing to take on other tasks, or did you just want to live that moment?
That would be a real challenge if you had other things to do, because you would be missing out on the rest of the experience, which was amazing. So maybe in a future flight, I could take on a task.
Okay, that's fair.
Well, I just wanted to hit some buttons real quick. You flew on NS-20, if I'm correct, right? That was a launch on New Shepard, the suborbital rocket that they have in March of 2022. And you mentioned that you got a ticket, and I was just curious, how one gets, how do you book a trip to space? Cause I don't see a kayak for Blue Origin flights, you know, or a Travelocity for Virgin Galactic. And I'm wondering, like, does Jeff Bezos call you on the phone and say, hey, we got slots, or how do you, I don't even know if you can talk about that, about how you can get a flight like that.
So you can go to the website, but just in terms of my story, when I heard that Jeff Bezos was going to fly on the first human flight of New Shepard, they decided that, yeah, and we're going to auction off one seat on that flight. And, you know, who knew how many people would take advantage of that? A lot of people would say, yeah, I'd love to go to space, but the first one, maybe not. But I thought, this is great. So filled out the paperwork and put in my bid and everything. And then they had the auction and the price just kept going up and up and up and up.
Oh, yeah.
So I thought, oh, well, I tried. Anyway. And so Blue Origin called me back. Sorry, you didn't win the auction. But would you be interested in going on a later flight? Oh, yeah.
No, not at all.
This was the fourth human flight, and so I bought a ticket, and it was expensive, but it was worth every penny.
And that's work-related, right? So you can deduct that on your taxes? Isn't that?
I haven't tried that first.
I was curious. There's a question that always comes up with these flights, particularly between Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic, over where space really is, right? Is it 50 miles? Is it 62 miles now? And of course, your flight is above that because Blue Origin's rockets can go above the Von Karman line. But, you know, you were in an official capacity at the FAA, and I was hoping you could put it to bed for Rod and I and all of our listeners of where you feel space truly begins. Is it 50 miles like the Air Force says? Is it 62 miles like the tradition, I guess, traditional Von Karman has said? Or is it a feeling? Right, like you just said, where you look out this giant floor to ceiling window from what seems like the ultimate space recliner, and you see that blackness of space and the blue of the Earth below, and you just register it as a feeling.
So the military, the FAA, and NASA all in the early days decided if you go above 50 miles, you're an astronaut. The rest of the international community has pretty much coalesced around the 100 kilometers. But again, our government, for a variety of reasons, has decided, we don't want to pin that down exactly where it begins. And frankly, I don't bother to get involved in the arguments on where it is. It is awesome. It's amazing. It's beautiful. And if you can see black sky and the curvature of the Earth, you got my back.
That's awesome. Did you take anything special on your flight? Like in a
yes, we just got to
Dramamine, you mean?
Carry a small little blue bag that contained up to 3 pounds worth of stuff. So I had some banners like for Stanford and the Air Force Academy, and some patches I got at NASA and the Air Force, and some little Lego astronauts for my grandkids.
Oh,
a variety of things like that, and so that was really special.
So would you, I think I know the answer to this, but if an orbital possibility came up and let's say you'd be spending with three other people a week in orbit in a spacecraft that size, would you sign on the dotted line?
So a lot of people have asked if I would want to go again, and maybe I have a surprising answer to you. Again, I've dreamed about this my whole life. But now I've had that experience, and it was fantastic. No regrets, no second thoughts. It was amazing. And I'm happy. So I don't have the need to do it again. But if I was walking down the streets and, oh, my goodness, we got an empty seat. Could you fill it? Absolutely. I'd be happy to take that ride.
Okay, so for the billionaires listening, and we know they all do, he'll take it for free, get busy, send the ticket. This has been a fun conversation, and you bring knowledge to the table that I don't think we've had here before. We've had people with opinions about regulation and new space activities on the podcast, but we haven't had anybody that actually has practical experience in dealing with them. And if you look at your crystal ball, which of course we always ask, What do you see in the future in terms of how this goes? You've kind of touched on this, but does it get much looser and more streamlined, or does it start to get a little gummed up? And what of the international regime? Because, of course, we're not the only country launching. We're not the only country managing and regulating.
Certainly a lot of challenges, but I am very bullish, very optimistic. I think we're just going to continue to see things grow and innovation and lots of great things happening. I see a lot more opportunities for regular people to fly to space, which is a good thing, in my opinion. I see orbital propellant depots and solar power stations and a lot more emphasis on satellite servicing and repair. I see a permanent moon base that is not just NASA. And I certainly see a scientific station on Mars in the not real distant future, especially if Starship has a successful development. So a lot of great things. One of the things that I'm most excited about in the relatively near term is what I often call point-to-point transportation through space. Mm-hmm. There are a dozen companies right now that are working on this. It's not like the 1970s or 80s where you say, oh, we need a government program for DOD or NASA, multi-billion dollars to do this cool thing. Now, industry's doing it. They're doing the trade studies, the designs, they're signing up customers, they're getting investors and so forth to allow you to depart from a place on the Earth and fly to the opposite side of the planet in just an hour or two. Think about how that is going to really change things in terms of not only how you travel, how you do business, how you communicate, how you get to know other people, other countries, other cultures, other societies. I think that's going to be a huge game changer. And I think it's just around the corner, and it'll be pretty exciting to see some of that take place.
Yeah, I'm really excited for that whole part of it. My family is half based in Singapore, and that's a 2-day trip, you know, just to fly there from the US. And if you could make it in like half the time, you know, or a fraction of the time, wouldn't that be great? I assume you send your luggage ahead of time. You know, you mentioned the future of commercial space, orbital stations. Blue Origin has plans for an orbital station. Blue Origin has plans for moon landers and whatnot. And we've been talking a lot about the regulation for launches off of the Earth. And I'm just curious, you know, to kind of look ahead, if the framework that has evolved through your time with NASA, with the government, with the FAA, has led to what we see now with, you know, SpaceX at 60 plus launches, looking at maybe 100 next year. Is that framework enough now to handle the private space stations and the flights that you know you're mentioning, the civilians and whatnot, be able to go there, or those civilian scientists on a moon base? Or will there be another transitionary phase to incorporate orbital and off-world stations as part of all of this?
We're going to need to change to adapt, because everything won't apply to these new kinds of situations. Okay. So I think we can talk about having a modernized regulatory framework. The same general principles of ensuring safety and sustainability and watching out for congestion. You don't want orbital collisions and so forth and so on. You want to be able to trust that industry is doing the right thing, whether that's through industry consensus standards or some kind of government oversight, but it doesn't have to be very prescriptive. This is what you have to do and this is how you have to do it. And so I think now is the right time to start putting that in place so that we won't come up against a brick wall and have to rethink everything and start over.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Well, I want to thank you, George, for joining us today for our discussion on space regulation and what it's like to be a commercial astronaut. I'm going to start counting my pennies and looking at a second mortgage to accomplish this, because it sounds pretty cool.
Maybe George can put in a good word for us at Blue Origin, right? They need to send a journalist, George, but pick me first before Rod, please.
So he's the slightly lighter of the two of us, so he'll take less mass. George, correct, where can we keep track of what you're up to online?
So LinkedIn is great, and happy to respond to questions or areas that I can can be of help. And really enjoyed our conversation today.
Thanks. That's very generous of you, Tarek. Where are you hiding your nerdy game playing expertise these days?
Well, you can always find me at space.com as well as on the Twitter, where I follow all things space. This weekend, and before you roll your eyes, Rod, this weekend...
I'll do it now. There you go.
You will find me on Saturday playing Fortnite with my daughter because they are launching a rocket in their Big Bang event, and I am going to be totally there for it. So that's December 2nd at 2 p.m. If anyone else wants to join me, please let me know offline. So
I hate to break it to you, Tarek, but as I told the young man that called us in the post-production bay when I was working on Star Trek just about every day, the ships aren't real. But I digress. Don't forget to drop us a line. Oh, goodness, I forgot me. Of course, you can always find me at pilebooks.com and my ever creakier website, which I am redoing this year, at astromagazine.com, my magazine. Don't forget to drop us a line at twis at twit.tv. That's T-W-I-S at twit.tv. We welcome your comments, suggestions, ideas, and your jokes. You guys are falling down the job, and we answer each and every email. Don't forget to check out space.com. Websites in the name, and the National Space Society at NSS.org. Brand new website. We finally moved off of Mozilla 3, or not Mozilla 3, oh, Mosaic. Just kidding. Both are good places to check and fulfill your spaceflight cravings. New episodes of this podcast publish every Friday on your favorite podcatcher, so make sure to subscribe, tell your friends, give us reviews, thumbs up, stars, five mustaches, whatever you got. And you can also head to our website at twit.tv/TWIS. Finally, don't forget you can get all the great programming on the Twit Network ad-free on Club Twit, as well as some extras that are only available there for about $7 a month. That's a bargain no matter how you slice it. And, you know, it's going to take a lot of $7 to add up to taking George's flight. So spend it on Club Twit because that's something you can enjoy right now. You've heard Leo talk about the hard times that are facing podcasters. It's probably truer than even that. So these guys can use all the help that they can get. So stand up and be counted. And you can follow the Twit Tech Podcast Network at Twit on Twitter and on Facebook and on twit.tv on Instagram. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next time. Take care.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club Twit. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club Twit Discord, a great clubhouse for Twit listeners. And finally, the Twit Plus feed with shows like Stacy's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit. And thanks for your support.
For the ones who get it done, the most important part is the one you need now. And the best partner is the one who can deliver. That's why millions of maintenance and repair pros trust Grainger, because we have professional-grade supplies for every industry, even hard-to-find products. And we have same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders. But most importantly, we have an unwavering commitment to help keep you up and running. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.